So, even I don't know a tremendous amount about you. I just knew of Mr. White when I worked at Blue Ridge. So, can you just give us a brief synopsis of your time leading into your job as director, or how you became associated with Mid-Continent before Mid-Continent, and then kind of a history of yourself, and then any stories that you can remember from that time as well? It's kind of the way we want to do it, and passions, accomplishments you're proud of, that sort of thing. So how did you get started? How did you come to Mid-Continent Library and all that, I guess?
Oh, well, I started a long, long time ago. Back in 1961, I got my degree from Syracuse University, and my first job was at Kansas City Public Library. So I worked there at the Westport branch and out at the Van Horn branch, which no longer exists as a Van Horn branch. I think it basically has had its... It went to Fairmount and then off to Sugar Creek. But after there, I went down to Lebanon, Missouri, as demonstration librarian, which was how the libraries were established throughout the state. The state library established these demonstration libraries, supplied the books, the bookmobiles, and you went out and you performed library service for a specified period of time, up to 2 years. And I did that in the Kinderhook area, covered four counties, and using the existing city libraries that were around, and then went to Springfield. And that was where some of my associations with Mid-Continent began, because John Ferguson, who preceded me as director, came from Springfield. In fact, I went to Springfield and took his job when he came up here as assistant director. Worked there for couple of years, and then went back to Lebanon at the regional library that had been established as a result of that demonstration and vote, and was there for another 20 years. So I had about 25 years total in that location. Mm-hmm. There were a number of things going on out in the state that had a direct influence too. As you're probably aware, the formats change all the time, but mm-hmm. at one point 16 millimeter film was a very important part of library service, but also a very expensive part. So none of the rural libraries could afford it, so they put together a co-op. And I became president then about 1966 and stayed on as president for a number of intervening years until after I came up here, and then still oversaw quite a bit of it while I was here. Mid-Continent, of course, had their own 16-millimeter film collection, but since it was a mutually productive thing, why they came to work together, and eventually the film co-op, the Missouri Film Co-op, came up and was headquartered here within the Mid-Continent library. They had staff from both all worked in one large department, and they sent packages of film all around all the libraries in the state. And plus,
I didn't know that.
No, I thought probably you didn't. Yeah. But at any rate, see, I was working with Mid-Continent at that point, and Mr. Leathers was still director, and Mr. Ferguson was still assistant director, and we worked very closely on that. Also in the state were a couple of cataloging cooperatives where they did cataloging. Their rural libraries couldn't afford catalogers, but they could work in the cooperative and get a better quality of cataloging. And again, worked with Mr. Ferguson in that capacity too. The and in that capacity, why we began to convert the cataloging using OCLC as a method, and produced tapes that the state library was supposed to keep and refresh, and you know, in looking down the road to see the automation that was coming down the line. Well, Mid-Continent, you know, had already reached that stage, had their own cataloging department and all that, and realized that automation was the next step. Prior to the time I came up here, they had succeeded in getting a building levy. Mm-hmm. I think it was 10 cents at the time, and they were, I think they had 25-cent levy that they were working with. But at any rate, they were using that and building buildings on a very regular basis, and you now work in some of those buildings that were built.
They still stand.
And so at that point, Mr. Leathers had died, and Mr. Ferguson moved up as director, and he didn't fill the assistant director spot for a while. He'd pretty much been running it already, because one of the important things that's made Mid-Continent so unique was the Consolidated Library District. Mm-hmm. And that was accomplished through the work of Mr. Leathers. But to do it, he had to spend a good deal of his time down at the legislature lobbying. That's the way you play the game.
I heard a story that he would literally like walk the streets and and really go out and talk to the public.
Oh, absolutely. And he was in all the clubs and all of the after hours and walking the halls and doing what a lobbyist does. And it took him about 3 years to get that law finally passed. Mm-hmm. It was a tremendous thing, not only for this area here, but it eventually proved to be very helpful throughout the state. In fact, you know, this is Missouri, the Consolidated Library District number 3. There were two other districts that got in ahead and took advantage of that law out in the rural area before they got it passed here. But at any rate, how I came into the picture. They had the building levy and were going full tilt with that, had their own construction company and all of that to build those buildings. But it became apparent to John that he couldn't handle that and an automation program at the same time. So he came to me and asked if I would come up and take that on. And by that time, my kids had all graduated high school and were off to college, and so I thought, why not?
Yeah, good timing again.
So I came up here, and I know you've just recently gone through an RFID tagging process.
Oh, yes.
It went pretty quickly. Yeah. The original automation and barcoding went much slower. Mm-hmm. We had several teams of barcoders, and we would go out and barcode them. But at the same time, it was almost like a major inventory, because you'd get a barcode and a book, and they did not necessarily match. Mm-hmm. So you sent the book back to find out where it had gone astray. And, you know, a lot of times people would get new editions, bring them in, just attach them to whatever shelf list they could find, and go on. So it was not only an inventory, it was a major cleanup process. So, and these barcoding teams also were involved in correcting a lot of those cataloging errors that had crept in through the years and years. And then, of course, there was also new library collections. The Liberty Library came in, and some of the other library districts. We started out with Jackson County, and I think they based the catalog on mostly on that one. But then there was the Platte County Library District, which was one of the first WPA library, I guess the first WPA library in existence. But that all had to be incorporated into the catalog. So there was lots of room for mistakes, and we went into that automation process, and it took several years to get the collection ready. And then at the same time, we were trying different automation systems to see which one we liked the best. And then once we made a selection, then it all had to be converted and put into it. So
I remember as a kid when that happened, and going into Blue Ridge when it opened as a 9-year-old, and there's these computers you sit at now and look up the books, and not this card catalog thing, you know. So it was quite the change, and I felt like I was on some sort of spaceship, or, you know, because I've been going to Robin D. for so many years with my mom. We would walk there because we lived up the street. And so going into Blue Ridge, It was like the, you know, deluxe library that I had never seen in my life. So,
Robin
yeah, it was like Star Trek or yeah. something. So.
Robin D was a little rough.
Yeah.
Now that all the story, every branch has its own stories. Robin D was one of the few branches that had an early drive-in library. They teenage girl took the family car and. Wasn't able to stop it and drove through all of the card catalog.
We have photos of the car from that morning in the lobby. And the story I've always heard is Gene Hendershot literally still did story time with the car sitting in the front of the... We still have story time at 10 o'clock. Yeah, come on back.
Gene was not one who got ruffled by us. And there's always stories about Gene. Kansas City has a history of being a very difficult area to work in as far as building is concerned. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are times when we were building North Oak, which was in Kansas City, we actually hired a lawyer to hand carry our plans, building plans, through the city district to get approval. And he literally moved the plans from one desk to the next and walked them through. And that was the only way we could get through. And it still took 2 or 3 months to get approval to build. But when they built Blue Ridge, why, the entryway was, I think, just 2 cars wide. Mm-hmm. And it was a very difficult thing. And there were accidents out on Blue Ridge from people stopping to turn in and this kind of thing. And it was a real problem. But to get approval for that, we went down and we had no luck whatsoever. And finally Gene decided that it needed to be taken care of. So she hopped on the bus, went downtown, and went into their offices, and they thought they had a tiger by the tail, but she came out of there with the approval to expand and widen that driveway and make it so people could get in without having... Gene was quite a lady.
Sounds like.
Very.
But she was the sweetest woman I've ever met in my life, too. I mean, but do you have any stories of Mr. Ferguson, John Ferguson?
No.
I everyone seems to have a story that we've talked to about him, and obviously he was director for a long time, but a lot of the articles we've been reading and seeing, because we're finding all of this stuff now for the 50th anniversary, really incorporates a lot of... He seemed to be a very forward-thinking guy who, obviously, Director of the Year, Library Journal in 91 or 92, I think. So do you have any memories of him, any interesting, funny, you know, stories that could be remembered?
Oh, my. John was a very interesting person. I actually wrote the application that got him Library of the Year while I was assistant director. But he and I were same age, pretty much the same background and history. I came from Kansas. He came from the Springfield, Missouri area. Both had 3 kids, and they were all about the same age. They played together quite regularly whenever we were, our paths would cross and all of that. John was very single-minded. When he went after something, he pursued it and got it accomplished. He was very paternalistic. He felt like, even though we at that time had 800 or 900 employees, he was deeply involved in all of them and would work with them if they had problems and try to make it work out. Give them chances to make it go. Very devout person, and he was, you know, he was involved in Rotary and in the leadership and all of that. He was involved in the leadership in each church. He was involved in the leadership throughout the state, the Missouri Library Network. The Missouri Library Network Corporation was an undertaking that was established to, you're looking like you don't, that doesn't ring a bell.
Well,
okay.
This is why we do this, because we find things out as we talk to people.
After the automation came through, it was time to try to draw common interests together with academics and public and schools. And so this network, Missouri Library Network Corporation, or MLINC, as we call it, was established to try to do some of this kind of thing. And John was a founding member, and I was a founding member. I was at Kinderhook. He was up here at Mid-Continent. And we worked together on a lot of those projects. And we did in-service training throughout the state. Eventually, they evolved into equipment supply, hard drives, computers, this kind of thing for a while, discounted prices to libraries that could be handled, big group purchases. Then we went on into databases, again, group purchases, and also, of course, the training to go along with it, that how to use those databases. So this has went on for some time. I think I was on the board for 25 years, all that one. And John was, you know, likewise served on the board with me. Now it is a part of Amigos, and you've heard of Amigos, I'm sure. And they're doing the same thing now. And actually the staff is still in place, but they're employees of Amigos now instead of...
So they merged or were acquired by...
They went together in that. And that's happened within the last 10 years, something like that. Where did we go from that? Okay, well, we continued with the building project and with the automation project, and the library was in a very big growth stage.
Yeah.
Mr. Ferguson came down with lymphoma and continued to work for several years after that. There were spells when he was hospitalized and unable. So while I was assistant director, I was still pretty much
assuming the duties. A president, vice president thing, when the president cannot perform the duties of the office. Yeah. Yeah.
And there were a couple of times when that got a little tight. We'd go up to visit him within the hospital and bring to him things that needed to be considered or decisions made or this kind of thing. And a couple of times he told us he didn't think he'd come back, be back to see us, especially around Christmas time. It always got that way. But we continued to work through it until he finally was able to make retirement. And then I think he went on to become ordained within his church. And
that's not surprising, given what I've read about him.
Yeah, yeah. So. This was a, he never slowed down. He just kept pushing himself and brought everybody along with him. Remarkable person to work with.
And then when he retired, you then became the director in
98?
I think so. Okay. Something right like there. That.
You kind of touched on working in Kinderhook in that regional system. And so that, I think, is kind of a smaller system, right?
Yeah. Basically, geographically, the same size. Yeah. Population-wise, not so much. You know Fort Leonard Wood. Well, Fort Leonard Wood was within the confines of Pulaski County, so between that and Mark Twain National Forest, why they took up a good part of that particular county. We didn't have major populations there other than a few of the cities of Lebanon, Marshfield, Richland, Waynesville. But they had a good levy. When we did the demonstration, we went for a decent levy, and it was one of the outstanding regional libraries in the state because it had the funds to operate on. again, we were tied with to Mid-Continent in that we have had a situation in the state of Missouri, still do, I guess, that quite often when something needed to be decided, one that comes to mind was investment of funds. The reply usually was, if it's not permitted in law, then it's not permitted. Yeah. And so the monies that came into all of these libraries, and I think that even applied here, was that the collector collected the taxes and put it into his general fund, and then it was doled out to the libraries. Mm-hmm. But the interest from all of that money was kept and put in the Road and Bridge Fund, or wherever the county commissioners decided they wanted to put it. And, you know, everybody across the state was faced with this thing, same thing. When the consolidated law came into effect, it specifically allows for the investment of those funds until they're needed. And once that was passed, then that became available to all of the regional libraries. So just as soon as that was passed, why, I and all the other rural librarians went out and took the money away from the county collector and put it in a bank and withdrew the interest. And that was a sizable increase for libraries throughout the state. And that came about from Mid-Continent's work there.
So it even reached down to Kinderhook and other libraries that were not just, you know, part of what Mid-Continent was doing then.
And then there was another major difference that went on there, that once the consolidated law went into effect and the various districts joined up into a consolidated library district, that was established. And there wasn't any more of the political give and take, push and pull goes on in the regional library thing. Those are all arranged by contract, and the contract, as you know, can be broken very easily.
Yeah.
And a number have happened through the years, including Kinderhook. To operate in one of those rural regional libraries, you had to be in there playing politics the whole time to keep the funds coming like they should. So much of your reporting had to go through the county commissioners and all of that. If you did an annual report, if you did a budget, they all had to go to the county commissioner and be approved and then forwarded on to the state level. None of that has to be done once the consolidated library law came into effect. Now, Mid-Continent, I think wisely, has always continued to, when they made a budget, when they did an annual report, they would take it to the various county commissioners, various authorities, and present it to them. They didn't have to get approval on the thing. They just presented it to them, gave a little summary of what had been accomplished in that year and any compliments or any or changes that had taken place were announced to them. Basically, it was just an information time and always a much pleasant thing. And, you know, no approval was necessary. We just made a report, which was politically a good thing. Mm-hmm. And they just took it and filed it and sent it on to the state, and everybody was happy with it. But in the rural areas, you still continued to have to go through the whole thing of getting, once the board approved it, then you had to take it and have the county commissioners approve it and then have it forwarded on that way and then come back. But that lessened somewhat. It still is required by law as long as you were operating under a regional library law or a city law or this kind of thing. But the Mid-Continent was the dam that broke that allowed so much of this to happen.
So that law is probably one of the more important library laws for this state, maybe ever, given how it affected so many other libraries and systems.
And when you stop and think that it took probably 3 years of Mr. Leather's life to get that accomplished. And, of course, while he was doing that, Mr. Ferguson was there running the library and keeping keeping the wheels on the wagon and going
yeah,
down the road.
Yeah, there's also a library system to run while this is on.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, it was, this was, they understood what needed to be done, and the board was in full support of it. They supported him all the way while he was doing that. And, you know, the end result was a mighty big plus for the whole state of Missouri.
That one was definitely worth it. But that time frame is probably very tight in terms of, you know, leadership and a lot of other things are being attended to besides keeping the lights on in the buildings, too. So.
But it was necessary that the board support fully because if not, why are we spending taxpayers' dollars to be down there getting a new law passed? Mm-hmm. Or if you want to put it more crudely, lobbying the legislators to pass the law.
Yeah.
So
that's the case with almost anything like that, is you have to play the politics and accomplish that way. So,
but the Mid-Continent continued to go on. We were building the buildings and building the collections. Got the automation system up running. When that happened, it suddenly became apparent that there were really no policies in effect. The library had been run by administrative memo. There was a stack of administrative memos like this that had been issued, and those were the rules that the library worked by. So one of the first things I did when I wasn't involved with barcoding the collection was to take that book and take it home at night and get some kind of a subject index to the thing so we could find out where we had decided what we were going to do. And we did publish that and get it then. And then we took that as a basis and began to rework the policy. So after the automation system was up and running, we went through and established a complete set of policies that covered all of the rules and regs that
they are still in existence today.
And they've had to be revised as we've changed the various automation systems. After we'd been through that, I think by the time I was library director, it was obvious that we needed to move into another automation system. We'd outgrown and outlived the one we had, so we did another search. We actually loaded up a bus of the various staff members from all of the various departments and from the branches and toured branches through Illinois, Indiana, through Missouri, looking at different automation systems, and came back, made our decision, and then started in on a conversion and went through that. And I think you now have gone through that again for the third time. And
yeah. The one you're speaking of is when it went to the Circe workflows, right. Mm-hmm. Which we still use in conjunction with the RFID software. So it's still being utilized. And I was at Blue Ridge as a substitute clerk for that, and I remember thinking, there's going to be receipts. There's going to be this whole new system, but it really did, because I had been used to what I call the green screen computer system with the wands and beep beep and the big date due stickers, and that's what I was used to as both a child and now as an employee. So being told that it's going to print a receipt that has the, I, like anyone at that time, was like, change? Nope, don't like it. But it turned out to be fantastic in terms of the streamlining of how things were done. It was a lot easier to keep track of things, and the software was so much more advanced. You didn't have to press F1 to... I guess you could still press F1 to check out.
On a shortcut, it's not like the menu. Yeah.
But, you know, it was more Windows mouse-based than, you know. So it was definitely a leap forward when that happened, I can remember, so.
But one of the other things that happened as all of this was going on, the building levy was a limited levy, and you know, it also became apparent with the new automation system and the growth of the number of new libraries, as well as replacing the old libraries, that we needed more funding to make it work. So we went through a levy transfer election. Again, I have done a couple of those throughout my history, the first one being down at the when we created Kinderhook by going having elections for in all of those various counties. While I was down there, I did a books by mail demonstration down in Douglas County and was able to get a levy passed there. So we did the same thing up here and went through all of the telephone calls and the speechifying and all of that that needed to be done to get the levy transferred, and we were successful again. The people were happy with the library service they had and the way it was being presented, so we were able to get that transfer. By that time, the state had been messing around, so I think it was down from 10 cents to 7 cents, and I think the 25 cents was down, I don't know where it was, almost 20 or maybe even less than that. But it, we eventually got back to, I think it went to 35 and then it was immediately dropped back to 33. They had these rollbacks built in, and so I think that's where they are still at this point, if they haven't had something roll back on them again. But you needed to fight that. But anyway, that was another one of the things that we managed to get accomplished. And by that time, we had enough reserve built up that we were able to, when we decided we needed a new branch, not just, or a replacement branch for, I think, of Lone Jack, we had another one, we replaced that one. And Red Bridge, we had a major renovation and expansion out there
to the building.
So we were doing that all over the district.
A capital plan sort of thing in addition to the building.
But, you know, we transferred that building money over to the operating levy so that we had to figure another way to continue to do that. And we have continued, that's continued on. There are other ways that we cooperated with the rural libraries. I mean, rather than be a big brother and tell them what had to be done, we worked with them. And there was one organization that grew up, the Missouri Public Library Directors Meeting, which that meets twice a year and either has programming to keep them up on things like insurance or basics of running a library or new legislation, or actually I do a little lobbying for governors or senators, this kind of thing. You know, it was always a good time, and we found another way to work together with them. We had a policy in effect when we were building collections that anytime we had 5 requests on a book, we added another copy. And so we would end up with several hundred copies of the bestsellers.
John Grisham.
And we found that the simple way to do that was just to keep a running total of what was going on and bring the copies up to whatever level we needed to keep to meet that request level. So quite often we bought from Sam's Club and got 45-50% discount, which was even better than we've been able to negotiate with some of our books jobbers, and could get the things in and processed and out to the people within just a very short time. But then, you know, after about 6 or 7 months, all of a sudden, every branch had 5-10 copies sitting on the shelf. And, of course, you know, once they didn't need them, why, they would ship them in, and we had the problem of disposing of them. We were also faced with, once the automation was instigated, we were faced with having to weed the collection there, but automation made it easy. We could simply produce a list, send it out, and let them pull the books that hadn't circulated in whatever time period we picked off and let the branch librarian sit down and look at them and say, okay, this isn't in circulating, let's get rid of it. Or if this isn't circulating, it still has good material in it that we need to keep and send it back on the shelf. But anyway, then we had this warehouse filling up with books, so we looked around and came up with a deal to set them up on Amazon for sale. And we were, once we got that moving, we were shipping about a semi-load every month to 6 weeks.
Still happening.
Yeah. I thought they'd were going to an auctioning.
I don't know what happens when they go out, but we...
It's a very similar process.
Yeah.
So. Still happens.
But at any rate, we went from using to have a stack of books, of withdrawn books that were for sale for 25 cents. I don't know whether they ever got to 50 cents or not, but anyway, to something that we were averaging right at $8 a book on those withdrawn books. So all of that money went back into our book collection. But things like the bestsellers, they didn't want those. I mean, they were still selling them new. We were ready to start withdrawing them. So I thought, well, if we can't sell them, why don't we give them away? So at these Missouri Public Library Directors meetings, we would load one of the delivery trucks full and take it down there and give them away to all of these little libraries. Now, most of these city or county or regional libraries, a new bestseller would come out and they would get one copy of it. Or if they were really flush, they might get one for each one of their outlets. Mm-hmm. But usually people had to wait 6 months, a year, 2 years to get the bestsellers. And so we'd take them out and they'd haul them off by the truckload, the carload. Mm-hmm. And we served our purpose, got them out and got them used. And even today, I think you can go out in many of these rural libraries and see books with Mid-Continent stamp on them being circulated and used. But again, it made for good relations with those groups of people. Back in 2000 census, that thing cost $250,000, and we didn't have that kind of money sitting around. So I went to the state library and wrote up a grant request and to get it. And since people knew that we interlibrary loaned microfilm, we interlibrary loaned books, and they were high demand, I pulled in a few tabs and a few markers and asked those people, since so many of them used them all the time, if they'd just write a letter to me to fasten to that grant request, so telling me how they were using those things. So I got a great sheet of about a ream of letters in and sent that along with the grant request, and we got the $250,000 to buy that complete census microfilm for the 2000. And you know, now it's not quite so essential. I guess a lot of our original microfilm were used in the digitizing process that now has it online. But
I would imagine.
Our copies were the silver copies rather than the cheap ones. So again, that interaction between Mid-Continent and the other other libraries around the state has continued, and there's a good relationship that goes on. Again, as I say, most of our staff are pretty much involved within their own branch or their own own system. For a time there, we were actually sending some of our specialists and some of our branch people out to conduct in-service training to rural areas, storytelling, those kinds of things. What else did you have on your list here?
Well, what you kind of, he was the one who basically did the research. It was like, here, and I was like, great, what?
Well, I mean, we've touched on a good deal of it, kind of.
I think probably one of the things that I'm proudest of, you had to ask that question.
Yeah.
We did spend a lot of money on our materials. materials change all the time, as you know. But, you know, we had a good amount going into books, CDs, and this kind of thing. And for a fair number of years while I was director, we were number one in the nation on the amount spent for materials. Mm-hmm. We were outpaced all of the major libraries like Los Angeles and Boston and all of those. We were only about 25th, 23rd in the nation in service size and population, but we were top on the materials and the amount of money spent on materials. And I was always sort of proud of that. Mm-hmm. Sure. Felt like we were getting the biggest bang for our buck.
I felt that going into other library systems like Johnson County and Kansas City Public, which are fantastic systems. Mm-hmm. But the selection that I have seen in Mid-Continent in years past, but even today, I always seem to find what I want more within the Mid-Continent collection.
It's always seemed like it's kind of a high priority to make sure we have resources and materials that people are kind of wanting.
So. And, you know, and we didn't just serve our people within our library alone. We were serving all over the country. And not just what you might expect, the fiction category, but nonfiction and some of the little more advanced areas, because for so many years there, we had a standing order plan with Baker and Taylor where they sent us a single copy of titles in the subject areas we specified to go to book meeting. And if they weren't selected as by some of the people, well, we still kept that single copy. Now, that I don't think they're no longer doing that, but
that's centralized collection development. Yeah, but I've seen the book meeting room when that was going on, and they're just all laid out there, and it's like a candy store for librarians almost.
Well, they did have book budgets, so they had to, they had to manage it a little bit.
Right.
But
I didn't know that. I always thought those were like loaner copies that were sent back, if not selected. That's interesting to find out.
No, we kept. So, you know, you would have one copy now, and our people tried to keep from getting them up in Edgerton or someplace like that, but spread throughout the metropolitan area, there was some very interesting titles. And if they weren't used after a specified amount of time, they could be moved on to sold and gotten rid of.
That actually is a good segue for we've kind of touched a lot about the legacy of Mid-Continent and the first 50 years, since that's kind of what this is all about. Yeah. It's kind of our 50th anniversary. So I guess how would you like to be remembered as a director and your time spent kind of being part of the leadership of Mid-Continent?
Well, I started out to be a librarian very early in my life, and that's what I continue to do through my entire career. And providing good library service to the patrons in as wide a range as could be made available was that was my goal, and I think I fairly well achieved that with the help of a great staff. It, you know, something like this can't be done alone. I think Mr. Ferguson had a saying that he repeated quite often at dedications and this kind of thing, but it was, you had to have the materials, and you had to have the staff, and you had to have the leadership of a good board to make a good library. And I think Mid-Continent has always been, had those elements available as they have moved forward.
What do you think about the future of Mid-Continent or libraries in general? As someone who has come through many, many years, are you impressed with what libraries are now? Do you see them? What do you see libraries in the next 50 years? Not just Mid-Continent, but I mean, obviously, you know, in 50 years we could be living on the moon or something. But are you impressed with what has happened up until this point? And do you see? The question I get from a lot of customers in the branch is, are libraries still going to be as relevant down the road as they are right now and have been? obviously we would all like to say yes, they mm-hmm. will be, but do you feel the same? Do you see libraries still mm-hmm. being an important part of society and, yeah. and for people?
Yeah. In fact, they may even assume greater importance because it's not, they've not been for the wealthy. It's an interesting observation that I've made through the years, but the wealthy don't necessarily use public libraries. They go out and buy their own material, mm-hmm. unless times get tough. And that's one of the things that I have observed as we've gone through various cycles of recession and expansion. When those recession times come, people walking through the doors in libraries increase, and the usage of their tax-bought materials increases. And then when they get a little more affluent and the money flows a little more freely, then they opt for convenience and they'll pick up the book at the bookstore or in the airport or wherever. But when times get tough, they come back to using the library. Now, you know, it's going to change, the electronic book, the audio book, the formats that we know. I mean, we've gone through I don't know how many. And, you know, it's always been a balancing act. When do you start buying the newest format and start letting off, mm-hmm. losing the old? I mentioned 16-millimeter films. Well, now they're electronically available.
Yeah.
But at one point, that was the fundamental thing that people across the state did one night a week. They would go to the library and watch the films. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there are stories that go on and on connected with that. But, you know, we started out with 78, then went to LP records, mm-hmm. yeah. then to CDs. And, you know, when do you...
But now records are back. Everybody's listening to vinyl. Yeah. So,
but you wonder, okay, now when do you make these moves? And that's part of what being a librarian was. You know, when I discovered that there were CD players and combines, I knew it was time that the library needed to be having yeah. quantity of those available, and we could probably start dropping off on those other collections. And, you know, that's always going to happen. And you know, the CDs that we have today, they're already planned out of existence. Now, what'll be its replacement? We're beginning to see the MP3 and all of this, uh-huh. but those two will change. But the information is still necessary, and I think we finally gotten to the point where people realize that just putting a search into the computer and taking whatever you got willy-nilly was not the proper way to do it. You need somebody who knows how to use those databases, the information that you find. And even back to the good old days of interpreting and directing them to how to further their search, mm-hmm. that's still going to be necessary. The idea that you can just take whatever you get off the internet at face value, we learned that very early, but a lot of people still have that idea. Mm-hmm. And I still hear it quoted to me, but yeah. and I still am saying, check out your sources. Don't just take it at face value.
Right, right. This website said, what yeah. website? Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's got to be true.
You can't lie on the internet, right?
Yeah. Wikipedia, I mean, you know, it's
anyone right. Anyone can edit that.
Yeah, it's right there for you. It has all the answers, at least what somebody thinks the answer is.
The best is when, like, somebody drops a touchdown in the Super Bowl and you go to their Wikipedia page and it says, the biggest loser ever, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, somebody's changed it because they're mad and they have to lock the article or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good point that we're a reputable source, that if you talk to one of us or come into one of our buildings, mm-hmm. you're going to get the correct information. Mm-hmm. So
there are so many instances where Mid-Continent has it been involved with libraries throughout not only the state but the nation. Mr. Ferguson served as a counselor on the ALA Council. I served for a number of years on the ALA Council. We've been involved in libraries throughout the nation, all the way from leading workshops and serving on voting boards and the network and all of that. But at any rate, it's all just been a forward progression as libraries have developed, and that's going to keep on happening. Mm-hmm. Now,
I feel like there's more partnerships than ever and more reciprocal agreements, mm-hmm. and everyone kind of works together as opposed to, you know, we all stand there with our arms folded and, yeah. you know,
we have our areas.
This is our library and you can't come in. So mm-hmm. I feel like that is still happening today. So
now there's always going to be libraries like this that are basically a very strange thing in a public library. It's a research library, and it developed from just a small room mm-hmm. in North mm-hmm. Independence to a department and then to a branch. And while all of this other was going on, the building projects, the automation projects, first Mr. Ferguson and then I have continued. We built the collection. We had a couple of interesting little old men who went out to all of the various bookstores and wherever there was a collection of books being dissembled or sold, and they'd go out and they would buy, and they knew pretty much what we had in our collection, and they'd bring them back, and we'd go through them, check them, and add them to the collection, all in the area of genealogy. County histories, now, you know, those all, a number of those have been digitized at this mm-hmm. point, but still, we have all of those collections, and then there's a number of those individual genealogies and the small little self-produced uh-huh. booklets of history and this kind of thing that are still in this collection, and I don't know whether they'll ever get digitized, but they're still here and available to somebody who's doing the research. So this is going to remain, I think, through yeah. the years. And again, I don't know what the numbers are now, but we were in the top 10 for a good many years, and maybe even more so.
And it's being preserved too. We took a tour and went into a room. It has to be kept at a temperature with the humidity at some certain point. It's all these old yearbooks from high schools, and they keep them very climate controlled. Mm. So it's not just information. It's being maintained and kept for future generations too, which I think is extremely important. Because the physical media itself, there's something almost like a physical book or a vinyl record, or the mm-hmm. physical act of going through something, mm-hmm. I think is very important too, which is why this building is significant today. So
it was interesting. Just as I was retiring, while we were looking for a site, I picked this one out back when it was still a farmer's barnyard. but we had to go through the 6 months of search to the board finally decided that this was mm-hmm. was a good site, and we had a few of the board members that thought it was the location. I mean, we were looking at access to the interstate and access to restaurants and places for people to stay, because we knew that people would be coming in here and not just coming in for an hour or an afternoon. They would be coming in for a week's vacation while they did all their research. And yeah. that's proved to be the case. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They have busloads of people coming in all the time from all surrounding states.
And this was a farmland before, and obviously it looks like suburbia around. So obviously this building has been, the area has benefited from this building being here.
There was
a
little house right down here that sat boarded up for a number of years, and a barn and a pasture and horses and cattle in it.
They're certainly not, the cattle are not coming in here.
No, but the deer still run along the railroad bed. Yeah. That's a major track for deer.
Well, and you talked about people coming in from out of state, and that's something that we've kind of talked about when we visited previously. And so I think that really speaks to the utility of it in the service. Mm-hmm. It's like you said before, it's not just the people that are in our area. It's, you know, for mm-hmm. a much wider use.
Nationally yeah. known. We've had people come into Red Ridge from out of, like, visiting family, mm-hmm. and they said, where is your Midwest Genealogy Center? We've heard we need yeah. to go there, mm-hmm. you know. Of course, it's kind of a library nerd thing. I mean, you go to, like, the Boulevard Brewery, you go see a yeah. Chiefs or Royals game. Kind of a specific thing to come here, but the people that come into the library are always asking us from out of town, like where mm-hmm. where is this located, because yeah. we want to visit it. So
I had someone from Colorado mm-hmm. that was their mm-hmm. first question was, I'm visiting family from out of town and I want to do some computer stuff here today, but I also heard about your genealogy center, so do you have any information on that? So
oh yes we do. Yeah. let me get that for you. So yeah, I'm really proud of the additions. I'm proud of all of the branches, but really this building in Woodneath and what Woodneath is doing over mm-hmm. there. It's in the 2 years. There's 2 years now since it opened.
Yeah.
I really feel like, again, you've talked a lot about how Mid-Continent was ahead of the curve, you know, with a lot of the things, technology. I feel like in terms of what libraries are going to be in the future, the buildings we're opening in the last 10 years have been, 5 to 10 years, have been significant for what is necessary mm. today. And we're working on getting the existing buildings into that realm as well.
And it's going to always be changing.
Yeah.
I mean, you're no sooner going to get them up to the standard that you're looking at now, and they'll already be changing to accommodate whatever new thing is down the road. And there are a million new things coming down the road.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is listen to some of the tech programs that are on there, and you can tell that the stuff that I can we don't need to go into that. I can remember back to the time I stood on the floor of the Missouri Library Association annual meeting, and the state library was wanting to give one computer to each library, and they wouldn't take them. And
really?
Here they were with the all of these computers, and nobody would take them. So I stood on the floor and at the state library's booth and said, go ahead and take them. You don't have to use them for libraries or interlibrary loan or any of the things they're talking about. You can use them to write your letters. You can use them to keep your books. You can use them for anything. And so they'd look at me and they'd take them and they'd go. And eventually they'd open them up and began to use them. But there was 10, maybe 15 years later, there was still one library that hadn't unboxed it, and a new person went in and found it on the shelf and told me about it. Maybe I wasn't
using it as a doorstop.
Yeah, I wasn't as persuasive as I thought I was.
Put it on the file cabinet, and here's this tool that could have been used. That's interesting. Today we wouldn't be able to operate without them, so that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's. And I had the.
Please take this computer.
Yeah.
I mean,
no. What can we use it for?
I can remember when they were first coming into existence, and I looked at them, and I thought, you know, this is what's going to happen. Is there any chance I can get to retirement before I have to learn all about hardware and software and all of this? And but no, there's no way. There's too much time left.
Yeah.
So I dug in, and maybe that's why I became the expert to stand there and talk to it, and then to come up here and start an automation system with very little background.
You were volunteered.
Yes, so. That happens.